The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we have one bill, and then we'll continue with our presentation by the Department of Corrections, their biennial budget. Representative Hillstrom, you have House File 411. Would you like to move that, and then we can discuss it?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 411 be laid over for possible inclusion in your public safety omnibus bill, Mr. Chair.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this bill came about because actually you had the hearing on sex trafficking, and I was intrigued to learn that under current law, we permit law enforcement to forfeit a motor vehicle if it is used while soliciting a prostitute, or in fact, if you take the prostitute back to your motor vehicle and have sexual intercourse or a sex act in the vehicle. However, if the John brings the cash to pay the prostitute, law enforcement is not permitted to forfeit that cash at this point. And so, Mr. Chair, I worked with the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and hopefully, Mr. Chair, after listening to them, you'll agree that this is a really good bill and that it should become law, Mr. Chair. With that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier, David Pinto. He's an assistant county attorney in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office.
Mr. Pinto, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here with my colleague Jim Mogan, who's also an assistant Ramsey County attorney. Mr. Chair and members, I specialize in crimes of violence against women and girls, specifically domestic violence and sex trafficking. I want to thank the chair for his really lifetime of leadership on crimes of violence against women, and also members of the committee for your work, and then, of course, Representative Hillstrom for her leadership on this issue, in particular with this bill. Members, this bill is focused on making some fixes to the forfeiture statute to permit, as Representative Hillstrom says, to permit the seizure of the forfeiture of money that is used or intended to be used in the commission of prostitution or trafficking offenses. Under the law currently, and I'm not a forfeiture expert. My colleague, Mr. Mogan, handles forfeitures for our office. Currently, under the law, 609.5312, personal property that is used or intended to be used in the commission of what's called the designated offense, which includes prostitution or trafficking, personal property can be forfeited, but money cannot be forfeited under the current law. The second sentence of that 609.5312 subdivision 1 permits money that is represents proceeds of designated offenses, such as prostitution or trafficking, to be forfeited. But at the moment, money that is used or intended to be used, such as by a commercial sex abuser or purchaser or John, if you will, that money is not forfeitable. And under this change, that money would be forfeitable, as well as money that is used or intended to be used by a trafficker in the commission of these offenses, such as money that may be loaded on credit cards, for example, that's used to going to be used to purchase hotel rooms or purchase ads on online sites, such as the committee is familiar with from other testimony. So this bill would allow that money to be forfeited if, in fact, it's proven that it's used or intended to be used in the commission of these offenses. I believe that's all. I think it should be clear from the testimony the committee's received in the past on what a concern trafficking is in our community and how widespread it is. And this would permit funds that are used or intended to be used in the commission of these offenses to be taken away.
Mr. Pinto, I have several questions. There's not a fiscal note, so I sort of must be a supposition on your part. Well, would Ramsey County know how much money we're actually talking about being forfeited? That would be question number one. And then secondly, so would it be forfeited to the local law enforcement agency that has made the arrest?
Mr. Chair and members, regarding the amount of money, I don't know that we do have a sense as to what that would be. We'll have to see as this goes along. Not sure if my colleague Mr. Mogan would have a sense of that, and I'm going to turn to him regarding your second question as well as to what happens with these funds.
Mr. Mogan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I To be honest, there's generally two distributions. I believe this would be under 609-5315 subdivision 5, where the money would be distributed 70% towards the appropriate agency. That would be the law enforcement agency. 20% would go to the county attorney's office, the prosecuting attorney's office, and 10% would go to the state treasury and credited to the general fund.
Mr. Morgan, or Representative Hilster, maybe it's even a better question for you. Like I'm intrigued by this, and I know that this committee has looked at the issue of forfeiture. Has been very quite controversial over the years about. And this is clearly a novel bill, and I would expect nothing else from you, Representative Hilstrom. I'm just wondering about creativity and use of monies. If you had thought about, if we were to approve your bill, is the direction of those forfeited dollars by statute required to go 70-20-10. I'm just thinking we've had a lot of bills and ideas coming to try to help victims of trafficking, and I'm just wondering if we're obligated to that tie or if we could create some kind of fund either for counties or maybe it's a bigger discussion for this meeting, but trying to be creative here. Representative Hilstrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, there is another place in statute where there already is a different distribution. And, Mr. Chair, I am happy to work with you to make certain that we are addressing crime victim issues as well, Mr. Chair.
I think actually I might have an answer to that. Ms. Pierce?
Mr. Chair and members, as the bill is drafted, since some of the money is taken under 609.322, that actually falls under a different distribution statute, and that would be 40% to the law enforcement, 20% to the prosecutor, and the remaining 40% to DPS for crime victim services.
Well, there you go, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pierce, are we still obligated? I mean, does the legislature have the ability to change those percentages if we wanted more to go to victim services, for instance?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilstrom, and I don't know how much money we're talking about. It could be insignificant, but I don't know.
I think it is not insignificant, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. And Mr. Chair, yes, this stuff is written into statute. We're proposing a new statute. We have the ability to write into statute whatever percentage should go wherever it should go. But, Mr. Chair, we just have to be mindful that you can't expect an entity to do all of the work of actually forfeiting the money if then they don't at least get the amount that they need to pay the bill.
We'll make sure everyone gets a fair cut, Representative Hilstrom. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom. I think this is a great idea, but I just have a question about probably more of a process question, really. And I understand forfeiture of real property. That makes very good sense to me. But can you help me understand, and my assumption is that all money, when we say used or intended to be used, do I assume safely that that would include all monies on this individual person would be intended to be used?
Mr. Morgan?
Mr. Representative and Mr. Chair, the idea is that is the loophole. That's the hole in the current law. If we can demonstrate that they are proceeds, we can already forfeit those funds. It is those funds that are present on the individual that are clearly being used to purchase the services that we are unable to generally tie to an actual proceeds of an illegal activity, and therefore are unable to forfeit under the current statutes.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up then. So as I understand it, if an individual is arrested and has $5,000 in his pocket and $200 in his hand, would we then confiscate $5,200?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Morgan.
Representative Simonson, Representative Chair, the we'd have to demonstrate that that was intended or it was used or intended to be used. A large difference between the rate that they would generally pay and the amount in their pocket would probably be more difficult to prove.
Thank you.
Simonson.
Thank you.
Mr. Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pinto?
Pinto.
I thought that was
Pinto.
I know you were sitting next to me. It seems that this picks up, I guess what I'm looking at is, let's say I own an auto rental, I own a hotel, all money used or intended to facilitate the commission. So I get paid by somebody, they come in, want to rent an auto. And then they use it to go out and violate these statutes. This is so broadly written, it seems to pick that up. And maybe that's what you intended, but I think there's a lot of auto rental companies or maybe hotels that are not knowingly working with the people to have this crime committed. So I'm wondering if it doesn't need to have... Unless that's what you intended, I think it needs narrower language.
Mr.
Chair, Mr. Mullery, I wanted to consult with my colleague who actually works in the forfeiture area because I'm not an expert in that area. Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, it would have to be proven that the money was used or intended to be used in the offense. And my understanding is, although I may need to turn it over to Mr. Mogan, that once the money's been handed over, of course, it may be more difficult to show that money at that point is being used to facilitate the commission. But again, let me hand things over because again, this is not the forfeiture is not my particular area.
Mr. Mogan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, the other issue on that would be what we call an innocent owner defense. The person, the wrongdoer has to be the owner of the property that's being forfeited. Innocent owner has a defense to a forfeiture. So that your example would more than likely, even if we thought that we could get to that funds, they would need to know that the property was going to be used in a legal manner. So in a case that somebody, for example, specifically rents out their car so that somebody can conduct an illegal act, we may actually go after them. Mm-hmm. But unless they knew that, they would be an innocent owner.
So, Mr. Chair, just one follow up. Mr. Mogan is?
Mogan is.
So is that in statute or case law? Or
Mr. Mogan?
Yes, it is. It's in 609-5312.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we have several more questions here. I didn't realize this was going to quite be so controversial. Representative Hellstrom, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarify something for me, please, here. You had made a statement was made about using their bank cards. If their bank cards were the funds from these personal bank cards are going to be used for these acts, these crimes. As I read this, it says all money used to or intended to be used. I understand how you would come to that determination, but has any thought been put into what if you got a kind of echoing on Representative Simonson, what if I have, or what if you arrest someone who has a preloaded bank card, what if it's a joint account? So if you got a personal account or if you've got a business account and you've got other people on that account who also have a legal claim to those funds, are we creating a legal nightmare here when it comes to that? That's just what I need to be clarified on when it comes to joint accounts or joint funds.
Mr. Mogan.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuberger, the if I had said bank cards, that wasn't intended. The monies used is generally cash on a person. I'm imagining that I would have difficulty demonstrating that all the funds in a bank account were used or intended to be used for this specific wrongdoing act. However, if that was true, the innocent owner defense would also apply. It may not succeed because forfeiture law does carry over the wrongdoing act on a joint ownership to the entire property. But, if, for example, on a car, if a spouse owns a car, generally the wrongdoer will, the innocent owner doesn't prevent the forfeiture of the entire vehicle. The case law is that the wrongdoer's act applies. But I think in this case that wouldn't apply because the cash would not be intended, or the funds in the bank account would not be intended to be used, could not be demonstrated to be intended to be used for the wrongdoing act.
To that point, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. And we're not making any changes to current statute surrounding forfeiture. So whatever the current statute is around forfeiture, this would just put this new set of money in. So we're not making any changes to what they already do in every other area. And, Mr. Chair, I don't think it's controversial. I think people just have a lot of questions because it's so novel. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we have nothing else.
We have a few more questions, though. Representative Neuberger, are you finished? Mm-hmm. Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, my question would be to Representative Hillstrom. I like the bill, but please keep it simple. Along the path, you're going to have people that want to mess around with this formula, and that's going to bring back to mind the whole gang strike force thing and the formula, and some people thinking that the law enforcement is doing this just to make money, and then some other people are going to want more money in the general fund. And this formula was put together over a long period of time with input from the chiefs, the sheriffs, the prosecutors, and so if you could just keep the bill simple like it is, otherwise we're going to end up with Tina Liebling amendments on the floor about forfeiture and a whole big food fight. So just my thoughts. Thank you very much.
Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just logistics, and I wondered, Representative Hillstrom, have you talked to police officers that would actually be doing the confiscating of cash? And I wonder logistically how they account for it, and I wouldn't want the police officer to be in a position where the John says, well, wait a minute, he took $5,000 cash from me, and the police officer only holding $1,000. You know, I just don't want to get in those kinds of situations where somebody, there might be some questions of accountability and making sure that the police officers are protected.
Mr.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, again, is not making any changes, and that is already taken care of. And we do allow forfeiture of cash in the drug areas as well. And so this is making no change to the accounting or how you report it or any of those things.
Representative Schoen.
Mr. Chair, I was actually going to touch on what Representative Hillstrom is talking about. All those things about forfeitures, this is not that. This is a different topic. This is adding language to allow a loophole to be fixed, in my mind. Exactly what you're talking about, Representative Kiefer, we have those procedures in place. I've done this many times, and there's different offenses related to what's allowable in forfeiture for DUI and what's criminal, so civil forfeitures and criminal forfeitures, and they're two different things, and they're very tightened up. It's a very strict procedure, and this bill doesn't touch that at all. I mean, that this addition, and I wanted to clarify that as well, too, and thank you.
And Representative Hillstrom, did you say you requested a fiscal note on it, or?
Mr. Chair, I thought I requested fiscal notes on all my bills, but I really don't recall.
One has been requested, I guess. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Very good. Do you want to renew your motion, Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask that House File 411 be recommended to pass and be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
Okay. So the chair will lay over House File 411. Thank you, Mr. Mogan, Mr. Pinto, Representative Hillstrom, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Can I get a motion to approve the minutes of February 19th? Someone, okay. Thank you for the Representative Savick moves the minutes of February 19th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. Then we will move on to our presentation for the Department of Corrections. You should still have your packet from yesterday. not sure what page we left off on.
Mr. Chair, page 31.
Do you want to collect these? Okay, are you ready to proceed?
Mr. Chair, yes, I am.
Mr. Chair.
Mrs. Sauer.
I have some questions from yesterday's presentation.
Oh, absolutely.
Can I go forward with that?
Absolutely. Let's do that now. Who did you want to answer?
Commissioner Roy, I think, would be the proper person.
Commissioner, welcome back to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Commissioner Roy, on page 2 of your presentation, you had the number of people incarcerated in Minnesota and compared it to other states with like population. And I was wondering if you had the numbers of people in those other states that committed felonies, I mean, what their crime rate was, so we could compare it that way.
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we certainly do have those statistics, and we would be glad to provide those to you.
Okay. And I have one other question.
Representative.
We found out that people that completed a substance abuse treatment or sexual offense treatment had a 27% and a 33% success rate. I was wondering if you had did any return on investments on that. It might be great for the state of Minnesota to increase the number of people getting those services if it does cut down our prison rates.
Commissioner Roy.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we certainly could correlate the reduction in recidivism by that percentage. It's not their success rate, it's the reduction in recidivism.
Okay.
And we can provide you, based on the fewer prison days, and that's a fairly simple calculation, and we can provide that as well.
Because it might be
Representative Savick.
Yeah. It might be very valuable to the city to increase those, to the state to increase those numbers that go through that. So thank you very much.
Commissioner, any other questions, as long as we have Commissioner Roy up here before we can continue on? So, okay, thank you. And Ms. Carlson, where are we now?
Mr. Chair, members, we are on slide 31, and we're going to start out with our offender education budget. So again, for the record, my name is Terry Carlson, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division.
Very good.
All right. This slide shows fiscal 13, so an annual budget for education for all funds. If you would want to have the context for the slide, you could go back to slide 12, which shows the overall institution's budget, and it will show that for general funds, education represents about 2% of the correctional institution division budget, and that's for general funds only. So this slide represents in the green the money that is spent on our adults in our adult correctional facilities, and the blue represents the 14% of our education budgets that are spent on juvenile facilities. And just again to put that in context, the juvenile population is about 150 and so represents less than 2% of our overall population within our facilities. But of course, their educational needs are greater, and so a larger portion of money goes to them for education proportionately. What this slide shows you is that adult basic education consumes about 44% of the money, although most of that money is either special revenue or federal dollars, as indicated on the information on the left-hand side of the slide. Library services account for 2% of the budget. Education administration is about the supervisory staff who oversee our education units in each of our facilities, our education directors, and our central office managers. Title I in the blue
is federal dollars also, and all kids in our system are considered neglected and delinquent, and so we're eligible for those Title I dollars. And the purpose of that is to have lower class sizes for reading and for math. And in another part of this slide, you see student services. That's for our corrections teaching assistants, for testing costs, and for support of all the programs, all the student work that goes on in education. I'm going to talk a little bit more about adult education now, and I'll get to juvenile education when I do a brief overview of our Red Wing facility. So education is a big program in our facilities. You can see on any given day we have about 2,400 offenders enrolled in some type of education. Our goals for our adult education are literacy, so delivering instruction to maximize academic achievement and to prepare our students for post-secondary education and the workplace. So post-secondary and career readiness is another big component of our adult education, and we provide a variety of career and technical classes for our offenders that we serve. Annual enrollment in education, you can see, is 9,000. At any given time, about 75% of our population has their GED or high school diploma, and even with this, in fiscal 12, we granted 638 GEDs or high school diplomas. So we're really working on getting that as a minimum standard for our adults to have that to prepare them for the workplace. In our post-secondary and career readiness, we have a variety of courses: business management, office support, carpentry, cabinet making, drywalling, floor covering, painting and decorating, masonry, computer career support specialists, printing, welding, and some computer network cabling. Also within the career and technical focus, we work on soft skills for the offenders, and also the career readiness, helping them with doing job interviews and just preparing them to get ready to enter the workforce. The next program that I'm going to talk about within our adult facilities, and this is just a couple of slides on MinCor, it's our prison industry program. Certainly within our facilities, reducing idleness is an important priority in our facilities, and our biggest employers, if you will, are education and our MinCor program. Having offenders serve in maintenance kinds of functions in our facilities and in food service. Right now, our idle rate is about 19% throughout all of our adult facilities. And, you know, we think that that's pretty manageable. We'd like to have it a bit lower because idle inmates are troublesome in our facilities. We are really appreciative of our MinCor Prison Industries. They operate in six of our adult facilities, employing over 1,300 offenders. Within our MinCor operations, we do lots of work for other state agencies. For the DNR, we do docks, picnic tables, and fire rings. For the Department of Transportation, we do mailbox supports. We do plow truck parts. The Department of Public Safety, of course, we do our license plate and tabs up at our Rush City facility. We do canteen operations for the DHS MSOP program. And for Minsky, we do a lot of building of dorm furniture, including desks, beds, and tables. Then we provide also laundry services for not only the vet's home, Department of Human Services, and our facilities, and also we do printing for a lot of state agencies. So MinCor is really good for our facilities, and it's also good for the state. It offers state agencies the ability to purchase products through MinCor in an easier, more efficient way, and I think our state partners really appreciate that aspect.
And Ms. Carlson, maybe you could just explain to the committee, is MinCor, is that, do you have a private vendor that runs MinCor, or are those state employees?
Mr. Chair, thanks for that question. It's state employees, it's Department of Corrections employees, yet back in 2003, that group of staff was asked to become self-sufficient. And it, as of 2003, the operation has been self-sufficient. So it's state employees.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Representative Mullery has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is, we only have, it looks like roughly one-eighth of the prisoners in these kind of job training or whatever it might be, and I know that, for instance, at least initially, there was extremely, for instance, just as a one program, I think it was cement finishers or cement masons, something like that at St. Cloud, and the recidivism rate was, as I recall, about 3 or 4%, something like that, for the people that came out of that. And so it seems that if we train them and get them jobs, they're not going back into society and causing problems. Why are we not doing more of that? It looks to me like roughly one-eighth or maybe one-seventh of prisoners are involved in something.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, thanks for that question. Like I said earlier, MinCorps operates at 6 facilities, and one of the reasons that we don't have more people engaged in MinCorps programs is facility space issues. Also, we have large numbers of offenders who, of course, need treatment. So at our Lionel Lakes facility, we don't have a MinCorps operation there because that facility is so focused on treatment. The other thing is that we're always looking for ways to grow the business, and it's tough right now to grow the business. We're concerned about a couple of our programs diminishing in size just because of the market as it is. So it always is our hope that we can continue to grow. We also know from national statistics, and I don't have the exacts with me today, but that our industry operation employs a greater percentage of offenders than many, many other states.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up. I'm not looking at, I mean, it's good that we're self-sufficient in things, but I'm looking at it as this person is coming out in, and unfortunately, North Minneapolis gets far more coming out there than any place in the state. And in fact, my first tour of the prisons, I didn't know what 411s were. People kept talking about 411s, and none of our staff knew what 411s were. And it turned out, I finally asked somebody, and they said, it's from the 55411 zip code. We have so many people here, and unfortunately, that's so they're coming into our area, and more important to me than having, you know, making money or something off of this is to have them trained for jobs. So why are we not doing more of that?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, our whole focus in our facilities division is to prepare offenders for success upon release, so I share that with you. And I think, you know, we try that in a variety of ways. We have work opportunities within our MinCorps operation. We have chemical dependency treatment, and then the release planners who help offenders with that component of being successful upon release. Even within our food service and maintenance areas, the offenders are getting some realistic job skills, and we think that best prepares them for release. Most offenders, and you're going to hear about our transition services in just a few minutes, but most of our offenders participate in that kind of transitional programming to prepare them for success, to build resumes and to practice job interviewing skills. We have transitional fairs that come to our facilities. So Ms. Heifert will be speaking about that soon, but we definitely share that with you.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment. I think this is a wonderful program. I share Representative Mullery's comments. This is a self-sufficient program. Obviously, it's kind of a no-brainer in terms of job skills and people being released to the community. I would hope that the department would try to place as much emphasis as possible to find new markets for new goods and to really, really get this program. You mentioned that there are some problems with some of your markets and things like that, and I would hope that you could solve those problems and expand this very good program. Thank you.
Good, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that support.
Go ahead.
All right, this slide just gives you an idea of the variety of things that happen within the MNCOR program, and I'm not going to read it to you. You're all very capable of doing that yourself, so I'm going to move on to our next slide. So one component of MNCOR is a program that we call Employ, and it's funded by MNCOR staff who help offenders who have participated in a MNCOR program or who have had credits in career and technical classes. So the main goal for Employ is recidivism reduction, and it's about focusing on the industry mm-hmm. skills that they gained and soft skills, so work values, ethics, responsibility, and communication. There are three stages to the Employ program. The staff work with the offenders in the prison doing a pre-release job search kind of training. So they're building their portfolio, developing their resume, and they're also learning interview skills. The second stage of the Employ program is about transitional period, and that's staff who will help the offenders get job leads that match with the skills that they've acquired and get some job coaching. And then the third phase of the Employ program is retention services. So staff are out on the streets working with these employers and the offenders who are placed in jobs to make sure that they have the things that they need. If they need some assistance with transportation, they might give them a bus card. If they need some tools to do their job, they might help them get the tools that they need. Or if they need a certain kind of dress, take them to the Goodwill or secondhand store and get appropriate clothes for their jobs. So that happens out on the street, and they meet with the employers and make sure all is going well and really try to keep that job, because we know that if the offenders keep that job, they are going to do much better upon release.
So is employ considered part of reentry services?
Well,
or is it separate? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's funded by our MNCOR operation, and it is a part of our overall transition services, but it's just funded through MNCOR.
Okay.
All right, I have one slide about our Challenge Incarceration Program. Challenge Incarceration Program is an early release program that serves right now 180 of male offenders at our Willow River facility and 30 offenders at our Togo facility for females. There's three phases to the Challenge Incarceration Program. The first phase is an institutional phase, and it is a minimum of 6 months. Phase one is a very rigorous, as it says, rigorous physical and military type program, but it also focuses on chemical dependency treatment for those offenders that need that, education, cognitive skills training, restorative justice, has the physical training and military bearing and drills and ceremony. It also has work crews and very intensive transitional preparation. You can see that the results are good for this program in that it reduces recidivism, and also we have a good cost avoidance to the state by having this early release program.
And Ms. Carlson, which offenders qualify for the program?
It is, Mr. Chair, it's nonviolent, mostly nonviolent drug and property offenders. There are exclusionary criteria in the statute, so people who have murder, manslaughter, criminal sexual conduct, assault, kidnapping, robbery, arson, or any other offense involving death or intentional personal injury are excluded from the program. Or if they were convicted of one of those offenses within the previous 10 years, they are excluded from the program. So there's mostly exclusionary criteria, and we want to keep out those people who are, you know, really high risk for violence.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who are your consultants and ongoing staff to determine whether it's military? Who are your experts?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have staff who have served in the military, and it's mostly about drill and ceremony and just doing that kind of physical training. So we make those determinations ourselves.
Okay, well,
Lesh?
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. I understand the point of it, but there's some history of that, and the military has a relatively long established history of why they do what they do, which may be different. Obviously, it's different goals from what you're aiming for, but I guess I'm wondering, I mean, having served in the military is pretty different from being qualified to implement a set of instructions that comport with military guidelines. So I guess I'd be wondering if they're former drill sergeants, former drill instructors, or if they've just served the military. Maybe that answers my question.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, if I made it sound to be that we're complying with military standards for physical training, that was an inaccurate statement. Really, it's about we want to get people efficiently from place to place and marching as a unit versus just everyone kind of lollygagging down the sidewalk to a spot works really well for the program. Having that discipline of standing at attention and focusing on how you appear, how you present yourself is very, very helpful for the program to get that internal focus.
Okay.
Members, if you haven't seen the program, it's really a worthwhile trip. I don't know that we'll have the time to do it, but it's a good trip. I think some of us have been around for a while. We've been skeptical of the program and skeptical of some of the research, but I'm convinced that it's a good alternative. And I think what Representative Lesh there, I mean, they're trying to instill discipline in a population that has not been very disciplined in relative to helping them, you know, obtain better work skills and habits. And a lot of these have been drug and alcohol offenders who keep recycling back in the system. So it's sort of an option, an early release that I think that they've been building on. It's a good program if you get a chance to go visit it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And the reason I ask is because they're selling it as military drills. And I think that means different things to different people. I went up there. I visited it. It's got the same horrible blue lockers and bunks that I had in basic training, and they set up the same way, and I haven't seen people screaming at them. Maybe they do, but I also know that probably most of the people that went through that program would have got bounced out of my basic training in the first week. So you got to handle them differently, and the goals are different, but because there's a different idea, an impression goes into people's minds when you say military training. That's why I asked. That's all.
Anything else? Please, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just recalling the studies on that say that boot camps don't work. Why does this work? And it sounds almost the same as some of the boot camp descriptions. Wow, that was quick.
Mr. Dewey.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Grant Dewey. I'm Research Director for the Department of Corrections. Representative Mullery, to answer your question, I think it's worth going into the history of boot camps a little bit. They're what's known as first generation, second generation, and third generation boot camps. First generation boot camps started in the 1980s, and they were very short in duration. They did not have any therapeutic component within the program itself. There's no aftercare, no intensive supervision. Not surprisingly, evaluations of those first-generation boot camps yielded very dismal findings. In some instances, participation in the boot camp increased recidivism. So, which brings us to second-generation boot camps, which started to provide some therapeutic components within the program itself. And for those second-generation boot camps, we see more positive findings in that participants had increased self-esteem but we still don't see a recidivism reduction. And it's not until the third generation boot camps, which have the therapeutic component, the intensive post-release supervision, and the aftercare, that we see a recidivism reduction. And the reason why is that it's important to provide that continuum of service delivery, that there have been some third generation boot camps which have yielded positive findings. And CIP has, since its inception, been a third generation boot camp. Unfortunately, most of the literature that exists on boot camps are those first and second generation boot camps. And within the literature, the case was kind of closed as to the efficacy of correctional boot camps. But I think going back to the military drill and ceremony, I think it simply provides an organized discipline structure within which to provide that therapeutic programming that is probably more or less responsible for the reduction in recidivism that we do see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was very enlightening to what we've heard a lot over the years.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have three slides left, and they're about our Red Wing juvenile facility, and then we'll move on to the community services half of the presentation. Our Red Wing juvenile facility is for the serious and chronic juvenile offenders. As of Friday, the population at that facility was 130 young men. Typically, these men come from families that are entrenched in criminal thinking and behavior and often have relatives or parents who are incarcerated. You know, they're also a challenging population because upon release, they are often immediately surrounded by peers and family members who not only encourage but threaten them with harm if they don't continue to do the work of a gang, if they're a gang member, or continue with the criminal activity. So it's really a tough, tough population. The juveniles at Red Wing come to us in one of three ways. They are either a commit to the Commissioner of Corrections, and right now that's about 12% of the population at the facility, or they come to us as a condition of probation, and that accounts for about 88%. And that leaves the determination for how long the juvenile would spend at the Red Wing facility in the hands of the judge and the county probation agent to determine really the best course of action for the juvenile. Juveniles also come to us as detention cases, and there's only maybe a couple, two to four at any given time, who are with us for very, very short periods of time, typically no longer than 1 to 2 days, but could be as much as 8. And they come to us from the surrounding counties of Goodhue, Wabasha, Olmsted, who don't necessarily have their own detention for juveniles. They are with us until the judge makes a determination of what will happen with that juvenile. This gives a breakdown of the juvenile offenders at Red Wing and what counties they come from. The juveniles who participate in our programming come and do cognitive and behavioral restructuring programs. They'll do skill development treatment programs like sex offender treatment and also chemical dependency programming. They'll participate in pre- and post-release transition services. And I'm going to talk also a bit about education for our juvenile offenders. So the goal for juvenile education is to maintain high-quality education programs that align with the Minnesota Department of Education care and treatment standards, and to promote lifelong learning for our juvenile offenders. Special education is a big component of our juvenile, the kids who need services in our programs. You can see 66%, and so 4% of our budget is on special education services. We have a new reading curriculum that we're using at the facility. It's called Read 180, and it's being used with the Title I students. And it was designed for students who are behind in reading levels by 2 or 3 grade levels. And the intervention strategies with this curriculum, the instruction, the assessments that go along with it has really proven to be pretty successful, and the students who participate in this program can improve more than two grade levels in a 10-month period of time. So that's a significant progress for us. The students who participate in that program, also 80% of them pass, have a passing rate on the MCA reading grad testing. At our Red Wing facility, we also provide career and technical programs, vocational programs of printing and carpentry at this point in time.
Are there still male, adult male inmates being housed at Red Wing? Or,
Mr. Chair, yes, we do have a unit of male, minimum security male offenders, and they're sight and sound separation with the juvenile.
They're in a totally different building, and okay, there. Mr. Representative Sean.
What is the security level at Red Wing? What would you describe that? Or, Mr. Chair, what would the security level at Red Wing
Commissioner
be?
For the adults and
no, for the juveniles.
For the juveniles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, it's a minimum security facility. We do have a fence that goes around the facility, but it doesn't have any electronics to detect or notify us if someone would be trying to climb over the wall, but it does have a fence.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoen.
So I think it was within the last year we had, what, three or four juveniles that escaped from Red Wing and were about the town for several days. And there was also, we talked about, this was in relation to the fugitive recovery group, and there was some number discrepancies where the fugitive, that the juveniles weren't counted in, like, escapees or... I can't remember exactly. It was kind of a discrepancy there. But so I guess I'm kind of curious, how did they escape?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen, the escape that you're referring to, I believe, occurred in October, but I have Warden Kathy Halverson here, and she could address that issue.
Warden, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Halverson, the warden at Red Wing.
Did you want to respond to
that question? Well, and Mr. Chair, first, you know, I'm not asking you to publicly point out every single security feature, and I don't want to jeopardize those types of things. I guess what I want to express my concern is, if I had one of these facilities in my community, I want to make sure that we're doing everything we can, and that that we're being open and honest when we have a problem, and that we get it fixed. So, on this particular issue, are you addressing the concerns of Red Wing and those folks that, you know, we've got a minimum security issue, but you don't get to be a juvenile offender placed in Red Wing for minimum security type actions typically?
Warden?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we absolutely are addressing the issues with the two juveniles that escaped from the facility in October. They were gone for a little over 12 hours and apprehended in the community. A good cooperative effort between our fugitive task force team and local law enforcement, including actually the state troopers were involved. So thank you. I don't want to go into great detail about the security enhancements, but we have taken actions based on the incident that occurred.
Representative Ward. Are you done? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is related to education, going back to your education. The population, it says, is 138. That's the maximum population of Red Wing. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair. Commissioner.
Maximum daily population?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, that is the population at the facility. So we, again, don't control intake. It could be higher, but right now that's the population that we serve.
Representative Ward.
So what, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the maximum population?
Mr. Chair, if I may. We are licensed to hold about 160 right now. We could go up to 190. We have a secure unit, but I don't count that in my daily population.
Okay, then
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I see that in fiscal year 12, 195 students were enrolled in the education program. So is that voluntarily or The state mandates of a child must attend education until the parents sign off. Or how does that work? Is it voluntary, or do some, because you have a different of variety of ages there? So tell me if you might please. I used to, as Commissioner Roy knows, I used to work as an educator in one of these facilities, and it was an adult facility, but it was voluntary. And oftentimes, they bettered themselves with education, obviously, but they also like the education department because, for a variety of reasons, but I'll go into. But so my question is it voluntary?
Warden Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's not voluntary. We have great success with our residents when they come in. We do evaluations on them. The educators, teachers have... and I'm not going to remember the name, a star evaluation that they do on every resident that comes in to determine what grade level they're at and determine if they're on a track for a diploma or a GED. The youth participate in education all day long. We have a six-hour school day, and we do a great deal of communication with them to motivate them to participate. Certainly some kids wake up in the morning and don't want to go to school, and so our staff work very closely with them to keep them motivated to go to school.
We have Representative Neuberger, Kelly, and Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I have a question for you here. I'm looking at your data. It says you have these two juvenile facilities, the one up in Togo. The question that I have is, whatever happened to Camp Thistledew? When I was a kid growing up, I'll just leave it there.
It all adds up.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Camp Thistledew is at our Togo facility. It's the Thistledew program, but we call it Togo. It's still there.
Neuberger.
Very effective program.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would agree.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for Representative Schoen, as a representative from the Red Wing area, I can assure you that past wardens and Warden Halverson here are very good administrators of the facility. And as she stated, whenever there has been an issue, it has been resolved extremely quick. Local law enforcement is right there, and just want to say that we've really never had many issues in that regard, and that they've actually been a very welcome partner in the community. So, thank you.
Yeah, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been listening to the whole presentation on the education and training, and I agree. I think we need. More of the IQ brain training and job training than we have, but also I haven't heard anything mentioned about what is a success for these people on coming back into the community, and that's your executive brain function and your milder mental health. My understanding, there's basically no milder mental health treatment, and I haven't heard anything of programming to develop the executive brain functions, the judgment, the character, all those types of socialization that is the determining factor on when they come back to my community, whether they're a success or not, and back in crime.
Warden Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, we do utilize a cognitive program at Red Wing. We use an ART, which is aggression replacement therapy, and it's utilized by Hennepin County Homeschool and many of the facilities that our residents are placed at prior to coming to Red Wing. So it's good continuity in the structure, and the essence of it is to teach the young men how to make different choices, how the decisions that they've made in their life have led them to where they are, victim impact, restoring justice, and how they can make better decisions in the future. So we do start that immediately when they come in after we do an assessment to see what type of risks the youth have in their lives and that we can attend to while they're at Red Wing. So that we can do an individualized case plan, work closely with probation officers and the community that they're going to go back to. I think the cognitive restructuring is one of the most important components of the program that we have.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, okay, for Red Wing, what if I didn't hear anything about for the rest of the prison population?
Warden Halverson, our commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, at our adult facilities as well, we have cognitive behavioral programming. Our chemical dependency treatment is actually a cognitive behavioral-based program. So we work on the same types of things within our facilities.
Thank you, Warden, for your testimony. You want to continue?
Mr. Chair, that concludes my portion of the presentation. I'm now going to turn it over to Kelly Heifert.
Ms. Heifert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You want to please state your name for the record?
My name is Kelly Heifert, Transitions Manager for the Minnesota Department of Corrections.
Very good.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about my work unit is the reentry unit, and we're situated in the Community Services Division. But really, our small staff number that work at central offices have a far reach between the work that's done in the facilities and then also a reach into the community, kind of to tie a bridge between those two activities. We coordinate reentry programming and the different opportunities between transitions coordinators, which I'll talk about, and then out to our community partners as well. So with those things in mind, we like to think of reentry not just about those few months before offenders leave, but our practices really start when offenders come into our facilities. So how we intake offenders into the facilities, how we engage them about transitional programming and change opportunities, and get them ready to take on a different mindset to make those behavioral changes that are needed for release. Each one of our adult facilities has what we call a facility transition center. And those centers really are a clearinghouse for different resources that they will need as they prepare for reentry. So it could be things like getting help with job searches, or even just to figure out what kind of employment skills do I have or what do I need in order to get a different kind of job. We help connect them with community resources like veteran services, perhaps if they're an incarcerated veteran. We can help them with healthcare applications if that's what's needed. All kinds of different resources are there. We also have an interagency agreement with DEED that we can safely bring the Minnesota Works, the job bank. We can bring that right into our facilities so offenders can view that offline and they can find what kind of work opportunities are in their area of release to whatever county or community they're going to in the state. Transitions coordinators staff these resource centers, and we have 13 of them all together. While I said we have 10 facilities, some of our facilities maybe have more than one coordinator. Like Faribault has an additional coordinator because of their release numbers and their high volume of offenders that reside there. We also have a couple transition coordinators who reach out into the minimum security units where offenders normally can't come inside to access those resource centers. These staff assist those men who are outside of the fences with those release issues. And then we also have two transition coordinators which assist with reception orientation, so that's the intake. And as I explained earlier, how we help prepare offenders for their stay in confinement. The main focus for those transitions coordinators is facilitating a pre-release class. And that's an 18-hour curriculum that happens over a course of a few days, and it has been mandatory in the past few years. And those pre-release classes focus on the kinds of barriers that men and women are going to face when they leave our facilities. So we talk to them about housing issues, what it is to be a good renter, how they can locate housing, what their barriers are to public housing. Through our agreement with DEED, we have workforce center staff who come in to actually teach the employment classes with offenders. So they try to prepare them on how to do a job search, to fill out an application truthfully. How do you address that felony in an interview? Because you need to be truthful. Those offenders do when talking about their criminal backgrounds and barriers. Also financial literacy, how to do budgeting, how to manage money with the limited money that they'll have when they leave. This last year, 3,500 offenders completed that 18-hour curriculum. And then each facility also hosts a transition fair. It's our opportunity to bring in outside vendors, community resources, agencies,
people who are interested or whose business or outreach helps offenders in reentry. So about 50 to 70 organizations come in, and usually it's held in the facility's gym, and they can meet face-to-face with offenders who are within a year and a half to release. It kind of helps the offenders understand what they can expect when they go to those resource places or what they need to do in order to follow through to be qualified. A very important piece of our work is helping assure that offenders have proper identification when they leave. They need ID to apply for jobs. They need it for housing, all kinds of different resources and issues that they'll encounter. So first we help them get birth certificates if that's what's needed. We have an agreement with Social Security in order to help them apply for duplicate Social Security cards. And those things in turn help us then in helping to secure them with photo identification, whether it's a renewal for a driver's license or first-time application for just a Minnesota photo ID. And this last year, there were about 1,200 state identification applications that were processed through our transition coordinators. Community transitions is another highlight of the work that our unit does. We help to coordinate transition coalitions throughout the state of Minnesota. These coalitions, again, are some of those same partners who come inside for these transition resource fairs, but maybe others depending on the region or jurisdiction that these transition coalitions are. But it's mostly faith-based community organizations, some state agencies, even our Federal Bureau of Prisons folks come to those as well to try to coordinate efforts, to network on what resources are out there, find out where there's gaps, how people can partner together better to get the job done, to be successful in working with men and women who are leaving. They meet on a regular schedule. Some are staffed or coordinated directly by our staff, but others are by through community organizations in which those coalitions live. Our unit also provides contracted services to different community organizations. Like I talked about, our interagency agreements that we have, we also have an opportunity we've contracted with Homeline, which is a private nonprofit in the community that teaches tenant basic tenant rights, but also how to be a good tenant and provides tenant certification. So through a contract with them this year, they did training for our highest risk offenders and also trained our staff then to carry through that curriculum in the upcoming years. We look for federal funding opportunities, so how we can get more different funding in so we can try to do research on best practices to find out what really works in Minnesota with our releasing offenders. Right now we have a second chance grant for high-risk offenders where we're working with some of the highest risk release violators. So these are men who've been in and out of our system multiple times. It involves four different partners in the community meeting the needs of offenders, release violators from Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, and Ramsey counties. So it features a housing component, domestic violence prevention, a community hub where all of these programs come together, employment services, and kind of a wraparound and intensive case management approach to supportively meet the needs of these men who are leaving and hope to keep them from coming back to our facilities. We certainly support other organizations out in the community in their efforts in applying for federal grants or for local money as well. It might be an example would be RS Eden and Twin Cities Rise currently have a Department of Labor grant that they're doing those same kind of enhanced case management for education, attainment, and employment success. So we're helping them in locating offenders who could possibly fill those grant needs and helping to coordinate meetings with those offenders inside. And we really serve as that conduit of information or point of reference to community agencies who are looking either to come into our facilities, to provide services, or need information as well.
Is there, I don't need it, need it at this point, Ms. Heifer, but is there like a chart or anything that just sort of explains all of these different programs? Because, you know, a lot of us are very interested in reentry programs, but there's, you know, the state has programs, the most nonprofit world has programs, and, you know, and how geographically that all works out. Is there a way to put that all on a chart or?
You know, Mr. Chair, I think we've been speaking too just about our, the way we're funded is, you know, we're small in our capacity, but even the transitions coordinators with whom we give oversight to are under facilities budgets and doing those efforts. And then I don't know really that there's a clear we have a clear organizational chart of our department, but different funding streams and in the community and who does what services, it is a little sticky, so I don't know that we have anything clear that we could give you other than to provide you folks who attend those transition coalitions and maybe some of the ways that they are funded or their contact information.
Well, it's just, I'm as concerned about duplicative services, but I just, I didn't even realize Goodwill, for instance, did reentry work until they came to see me the other day. And then the network and RS Eden, of course, and the Metro, mm-hmm. and I don't know if our services in Greater Minnesota, are they on par with what's happening in the Metro? It seems to me there should be some kind of way to look at what's out there but maybe that's...
Well, Mr. Chair, one thing that we're looking at doing is trying to coordinate efforts better between all these transition coalitions. We've had our one transition coalition historically in the Twin Cities, and it's been called the DOC Transition Coalition. That's been meeting for over 15 years, and then within the last 5 years, we've been actively engaging different communities around the state to do those same things, but how we can bring all of those organizations together to try to locate resources throughout the state will be our next undertaking in the department for the next year for our unit.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think you're going down the right line, and I'd like to see further some studies as to the effectiveness of these different reentry programs, both overall effectiveness and then dollar per dollar effectiveness, because we aren't rich in money here, but we need to spend money on what's effective. And I remember meeting with job placement, some of your job placement staff, and I was shocked that they hadn't thought of even some ideas, which, you know, the last person that should be thinking of them is me, and they didn't even. So I think there's a real question how effective they are, and I think following up with what Chair Paymar is asking, I think I'd like to see some effectiveness too. And hopefully we can get something back from you on that.
Cypher, thank you. So, okay, we don't have much time left. Do you want to start your presentation and we'll just pick it up later, Deputy Commissioner, or...
Mr. Chair, I'd prefer to wait so that I can get through the entire presentation,
okay,
because I'd like to present the information.
That might be better.
Be rushed through it.
Okay, sorry we didn't get to you, but
that's
better.
Fine. Reentry is very important, and that's why we put it in between here. So
Ms. Heifer, maybe we can figure out a way to get some of that information to the committee in a way that we can understand it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think we can provide some of what you're looking for, but I think it's important to note that much of what our reentry services unit does is taps into local resources. So much of the funding and many of the services are provided at the local level. And we do have, you know, lists that indicate who are all of the transition members are that we meet with in the transition coalition and how we provide those links to offenders coming out of prison. And they are a very important resource for the offenders, but also for us to utilize in transitioning those offenders.
Well, I think even having a list of the transition coalition would be helpful, and then what Representative Mullery asked, I think, is good. I mean, obviously they're getting either state funding through DEED or they're getting foundation support, and so, you know, what is their research showing? And because you raise a good point about wanting to measure success here, so. We have several bills up tomorrow, including the breeder bill, Representative Lesh. Just to make an announcement, my intention was, this is okay, was to give 15 minutes to the proponents and 15 minutes to the opponents of that bill. Is that going to be satisfactory, Representative Lesh?
I think it is, Mr. Chair. With the caveat that 15 minutes for the opponents and then maybe a half hour for the proponents might be good. I was just kidding, Mr. Chair. Equal time is equal time is just fine, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
If there's no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.